Welcome back to the Guardian with Joy and Holly Radio Show. Happy that you're with us today. Holly, let's go to the hotline and bring in our guest for this week.
Sally Jean Cunningham is an author, writer, master gardener, and leads garden tours nationwide. She has an informative book, The Great Garden Companions, a companion planting system for beautiful, chemical-free vegetable gardens. Welcome to the program, Sally.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, I will start with this. I think many people have a misconception about what companion planting is. So what is companion planting to clear all this misinformation up here?
Well, yes, because there's been about 25 years of confusion and misinterpretation on this. And I wrote this book originally because I was a little ticked off at some of the silliness. I was science-oriented, working with Cornell University, and I had learned a lot that there's reasons that some plants go better together than others, but they would all say, oh, the marigolds. You put them around the garden and they chase away all the other bugs. Well, no, possibly marigolds and some other insects may confuse some pest insects coming in. But companion gardening really is about putting plants together that serve each other's needs in both practical ways, and they attract beneficial insects that help to support a healthy garden. The short way to say this, it's about biodiversity. A biodiverse garden full of flowers, herbs, and vegetables together, somewhat mimicking nature's strengths.
Right. And we see all of these goofy charts online. 27 chart says this, 4 says the opposite. And if you plant this next to that, it will make that sweeter. That's not how that works.
No, it really isn't. I remember my original research finding out what you were saying, that this one said, oh, this likes that and this likes this. Well, that's all kind of cute and fuzzy, but I was putting 3x5 cards all over a huge table saying, oh, greens go with onions, but they can't go with them. So what you just said is the case. So what I did was break it down into first the practical where, okay, some plants prefer shade, so you put lettuces and spinach in the shade of climbing beans, or in the earlier season, climbing peas. So there's a practical companion arrangement. And sometimes they're companions because they do repel critters. If you put alliums, lots of the onion plants around certain things, they do scare off, hey, animals as well as some of the other flying insects that just don't discover their beans. So there's a number of reasons, but honestly, when I finally learned more and more and more, and I did this through Rodale Institute, and I went to Cornell courses, but at that time, they were very chemical-oriented still, but organic was taking over. Into the 90s, finally, people were caring more and were sort of reverting back to the 70s original organic movement. But we were finally finding out that really the best companion plants are the ones that bring in beneficial insects. If you just invite certain things, if you put dill around the broccoli or dill around the Brussels sprouts, well, the dill attracts parasitoid wasps that actually lay eggs on cabbage beetles and do certain things that cause the bad guys to die, or the next generation of them to die. So really, if you bring in good flowers and herbs, you are attracting a whole population you can maintain of good workers for you. It's putting Mother Nature to work. And especially if you care to do organic, you're not going to go do a quick fix pesticide to get rid of something. You want to set up a system that is self-sustaining. Do I make sense?
Absolutely. That really does make a lot of sense. And if someone is new to companion planting, you know, aside from your book, what are some other resources, especially local, to them to get started?
Well, I think that these days, the cooperative extensions in most states and the master gardeners who've been trained, and I suspect that there are organic gardening communities everywhere that really discover some of this, sometimes the hard way and sometimes by doing their own research or finding books and writings like mine. But I think there's hope, and I would go to a master gardener, and I would also experiment. Do raised beds and try some combinations and see what is the result. And don't be quick to kill something that looks like a pest. Get insect books and little tiny magnifying glasses and start looking at what they really are and what they really are doing. It's quite magical. And the more you start to pay attention to the insect world in there, it's like bird watching. You get to name your insects and make lists and understand, because 95% of the insects in a vegetable garden or a flower garden are good guys doing something very useful, and our entomophobic culture just wants to kill everything as soon as it's creeping or crawling. And once the more you know, the less you're willing to kill things, and you want to trust that there's something interesting going on. So it's a different angle on the garden.
Well, let's talk about your book, Great Garden Companions. Tell us a little bit that's something of interest inside the book that would inspire our listeners to pick up a copy.
Well, yes, it's fun for me after really many years to find that people will come to me with a muddy copy of the book and said, would you sign it again? I take it out there all the time. Or they want one for their daughters. And by the way, just an aside, my book was just translated into the Korean language and is selling in Korea because they're having an organic gardening movement. It's the kind of thing that's like a dream for an author. So that was exciting. But I think a practical thing then that readers might get out of it is that it's hard to set up your rotation of your garden every year. What should go with what? You have 10 by 20 feet or 20 by 40 feet, and where are you going to place everything each year? Well, what I found out of a lot of practical experimentation is that certain things go well together, and it makes kind of like a little neighborhood. You have friends and family and invited in insects, and those things work together. And in a larger garden, you just rotate that family for planting in the next patch next year. So you sort of rotate the neighborhoods, and it takes the craziness of planning it all away. I made a fairly easy rotational system. Of course, you don't rotate strawberries and asparagus, but most things you do want to change them around because they're using the soil differently.
Fantastic. So just to kind of switch gears here, you have a passion for leading garden tours. Where did that come from? How did you get into leading garden tours?
Well, in my case, I was sort of becoming famous on TV as the garden lady because I was the cooperative extension person who got up there with the news every Sunday morning and answered questions. And I ended up doing that for a couple of decades and created somewhat local fame in Western New York State and Pennsylvania to the point that AAA said, oh, we hear this garden travel stuff is getting hot. Do you think you could take people to some gardens here and there? Oh, of course I would love to. So I developed that as another job. You don't get rich writing garden books, but I did develop my travel tour leader job, and it suits my personality, and I take people to the Chelsea Flower Show in London or this coming week, the Philadelphia Flower Show. Twice in a row, I go back and forth with motor coaches and filled up buses. And it's a wonderful, but we also do it locally because Buffalo, who would think, has the largest garden tour in the country. It's just like an oxymoron. Gardening in Buffalo? They think we're nothing but snow and chicken wings, and the Buffalo Bill's not quite making it. but the tourism thing is here to stay, and gardening improves cities, and it builds neighborhood pride. there's so much positive to this gardening world in urban settings. So it's really made a huge difference in Buffalo, and I'll take people out from this area, but also hope to bring them into the Buffalo region. And they're quite surprised at the end of July to find this weekend with 400 gardens open to the public for free. And it's a really cool thing.
Well, you may not get rich writing garden books, but you're having the time of your life and you're doing what you love.
Yes, and it's really important to me to help people do things organically. Let's be kind to Mother Nature, because there's a lot of problems out there. So we do what we can, and in a home garden, there's absolutely no need to go spraying and killing things. It isn't the end of the world if your pepper has a spot on it, but it does matter what we're breathing and what we're leaving here for the birds and the insects and so forth. So I appreciate that most of your listeners, I think, probably think like this.
Well, and there's a certain level of new beginner that's all they've been conditioned. If it's bad, spray it. And we as educators have to change that mindset. It's not that they're dumb, because they just don't know.
That's right. Absolutely. You take people where they're starting from, and there's a lot of big businesses that are telling people in April, you got to start spraying your lawn. Well, why are you doing this? So I think it's a learning process, and I also think that we need compassion for the little critters. And if a kid can just go, whack, I killed it. Well, what did you kill? What was it doing?
Right.
What was the purpose of that? We need empathy for the creatures out there. It's quite a process, and I think gardening is about systems, not just cause and effect, and you just go kill something. It's not quite the approach. I just did a huge home show where I gave a talk, and one of my most, I was appreciated, I think, for the line that garden maintenance isn't about killing things. And I got warm response from that one. So it's one little message at a time.
Absolutely true. So, you know, I enjoy going to botanical gardens myself. If somebody was looking, you know, for a specific garden tour, aside from perhaps what the botanical garden is providing, how would you find garden tours, or maybe like a garden tour group or something like that?
Well, the internet is magical now. That made it a lot easier than we were all inventing this sort of thing. There's a couple of books about 1,000 gardens to see in the world before you die, or garden tourism. Just that topic will bring up a lot. I have gotten to many states. I have certainly come out there to Minnesota and spoken in a couple of the botanical gardens, and just everywhere is different. Each place has its own magic. Whether you go to California, I have not been to the Seattle flower show, which I hear is astounding. So I think a good place to start probably is to go to some of these seasonal flower and landscape shows. There's some of them over the country. And I would also look up, if I went to any other city, I'd look up botanical gardens near you. And there's no state that doesn't have some wonderful ones.
Well, Sally, we greatly appreciate the time you've offered Holly and myself and all of our listeners. Can you tell us how we can find your book, find out more information about you?
Sure. Both books, the companion gardening book, is still at Barnes & Noble and places like that. It is available through Amazon. It's published by Penguin now. And that's my first baby, and it sold 75,000 copies over a long time. But it's wonderful to see it still being picked up kind of by a new generation of younger gardeners starting out with their organic lives. But my other book is Buffalo Style Gardens, and it tells how we created a garden tourism mecca here. So that one is out there too, Buffalo Style Gardens. And if people find it, we have a website. I'd be happy to send them a signed one, buffalostylegardens.com. So thank you for your interest, and I'm thrilled to have had your phone call.
Well, we thank you for your time and your information that you've not only taught Holly and myself, but all of our listeners. We thank you for that.
Oh, good. Thank you for calling.